Captain. Conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Oh, the whole field's caught up by the woods, the fires, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in a Trenton hospital. Now, here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C.
It probably goes to sort of the culture of the time, because, you know, I think nowadays something like that happens. If it was like a real breaking news event, like a 9/11 type thing, I think, like, given the oversaturation of media we have now, your first inclination is to flip to, like, all of the different news stations, you know? You're like, well, put on Fox, see what they're saying on that. Put on MSNBC, you know? And it probably speaks to sort of the mindset of the people back then that it was, once they were locked in on that, they didn't flip to the other station to find out what they were reporting. Because you almost wonder, like, why didn't they flip to NBC instead of CBS or check during, you know, see what the hell was going on? But apparently, I think some people probably did, but obviously a lot of people didn't.
And there wasn't the assumption that every network would have its own reporter out in the field. You know, It made kind of sense. Okay, well, there's this CBS reporter. He just happened to be there when it happened. And they, like, you know, today we would think, okay, well, Fox is there, CNN, NBC. We'll get all these multiple feeds. But I think it was, it's like, okay, there's a reporter there, and he's just telling us what happened. Now, some people did, you know, turn around and scan the dial and didn't find anything else. And that's, you know, not everyone was fooled, but a lot of people, it was just such compelling radio, you know, you didn't want to turn away.
Right.
And he, you know, Wells used it very well. He would just have the report, like, cut off, and then they would just go to, like, bland orchestra music, and that would play for a while. He would be like, what's going on? You know, and it sounded like a networking chaos that didn't know what to do. And he played it very well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's, as I said, it's tremendous stuff, even hearing it today. I encourage folks to go out and check it out on YouTube. Just punch in War of the Worlds 1938, and you can hear the whole thing. Now, you mentioned in the book at one point, and I'm probably going to get the roles of these technical people wrong, but at one point, there was a station break in the middle of the show at about 35 past the hour, and somebody got a call, like, right before the station break, and they wanted to go in and either stop the show or break in and sort of, like, admit that it was all a show, and one of the producers stopped him from getting into the room to stop it. That's I'm telling that part, right?
Right.
Okay.
They wanted to go in and they wanted to go in and just say once again, hey, don't worry, this is not real. But I think it was Houseman who stopped him from doing that.
Okay. I guess the piggyback question onto that is, I presume up until the phone call came in, they absolutely had no idea that there was this panic underway. But following that and following the station break, which I presume, you know, they had kind of maybe a minute or something like that to decompress and get ready for the next half of the program, were they informed that this was going on?
Yeah, they knew around halfway through when they, about 8:35 p.m., the show breaks for station ID. And they knew during that time, this when they got a phone call. Houseman got a couple of phone calls. One was from, you know, this sort of very angry person. I think it was a mayor from some city or somewhere saying, what are you doing? And then he also, the producers heard from the CBS switchboard. They were in the main CBS headquarters in New York City where they were broadcasting, and the switchboard was basically melting down because people were just, thousands of people were calling in saying, what is going on? And so they had some ideas like, uh-oh, something is going on. And so then, but they didn't really have any time to react. They just had to get back on and do the rest of the show. And then as you mentioned earlier, at the end of the program, you know, Wells comes on, and I think this is where people get the idea that it was a trick, that it was intentional, because he basically says, oh, this is our own radio version of sort of dressing up in the sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo, because it was the night before Halloween. So he kind of laughs it off, like, hey, it was just a joke. And I think that was done, you know, obviously to just sort of calm people down a little bit. I don't know if that was written beforehand or not. It's sort of one of the questions. But yeah, they definitely knew about halfway through, but they didn't know the extent of it until after the broadcast was over, and they really had time, you know, and then people from CBS could come in and tell them, like, hey, here's what's going on. Also, once the broadcast was over, they had New York City police officers who basically stormed the studio and was basically very angry and looking for, you know, who's doing this and why are you doing this, and they started confiscating things. And you know, when you see police officers burst through the door, that's when you kind of know things have maybe not gone the way you expected.
Yeah, that's generally a good indicator of things. So, you know, that kind of concludes the program, and at that point, just essentially kind of like all hell breaks loose, right? Because, I mean, we're talking like this is like 9 p.m. on a Sunday night. There's plenty of time for the aftermath to unfold. You know, we're not talking like 1 a.m. where they're like, we'll deal with this in the morning. This is like still pretty crazy time after the program aired.
Right. And it was sort of perfect for the newspapers because they were, you know, it was happening in New York, had all the big New York City newspapers and the wire services, all of their guys were in New York. And remember, newspapers hated radio, because radio was taking away their market share. Radio was taking away the dominance of the newspaper. Suddenly, people had another source for news and entertainment. And so newspapers in general hated radio. And it became clear very quickly, all right, we just got this arrogant, you know, 23-year-old Broadway genius in there, you know, who just scared the heck out of half of America. And so they're just, and these reporters were just, you know, drooling at this spot. And so they really went after it hard, and they really pushed it. And because it was only 9 o'clock at night, they still had a few hours before they had to, file their stories. And this is back when, you know, they had like, you know, morning editions of the paper and evening editions. So they had plenty of time to, write stories and interview people and get it in the papers, so that people would see it when they woke up the next morning. So again, this sort of timing was just perfect.
Right. And it's amazing that the network, they essentially kind of threw Wells to the wolves, Wells and Houseman, but especially Wells, you know, because not only did he have to face the reporters that night, but then they threw him out there the next morning at a press conference where, again, you can see this stuff on YouTube. It's amazing.
Yeah, and he looks horrible.
Yeah,
and
he looks haggard, just worn out.
Right, and I don't think it's an act. I mean, in later years, he would claim, oh, I was just trying to act very innocent. And you look at it, and he looks like a scared 23-year-old, you know?
Yeah.
And he's really been run through the ringer. But you're right. I mean, it's fascinating because CBS, this huge broadcasting network, they basically, you're right, they hung him out to dry. They basically said, okay, you go out there and you explain what you just did, because we're not, because we're really, really afraid.
We're afraid
that we're going to get sued, and we're more afraid that we're going to get our broadcast license revoked, because the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, had a lot of authority, they still do, but even back then, you know, they could take down a station or a network if they thought that they had done something improper, or at least they could try to. It was not a good thing for CBS at all. So you're right. They threw Orson Welles to the wolves. And he did the best he could. I think he actually came up, if you read, I have a transcript of his statement and some of the interviews that he did after that. I think he did pretty well under the circumstances. You could see why he was such a good actor. You know, he was very erudite. He came up with, you know, very, you know, just great. It was just a great performance. He did the best he could.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing. Now, to separate to go back and sort of separate the fact from the fiction, I mean, everybody's heard about the chaos that resulted from the broadcast. But you've done an amazing job in the book of sort of going through a whole bunch of different areas and regions of the country, and you don't have to do all that here and now. But, I mean, give people sort of an idea of what the frenzy really was like, as opposed to maybe what they might think it was like.
Sure, sure. Well, I think one of the big misconceptions, I think, not so much today, but certainly back then, but even some people may still think this, I think some of the rumors that came out were that people had killed themselves because of this. They were so afraid of being invaded by Martians that they killed themselves, or either intentionally, or they ran off the road. There were reports of, you know, serious injuries, people in car accidents, and all these horrible things. And this is what the reporters, this is why Wells looked so horrible at that press conference, because the reporters had just been telling him this stuff for like 8 hours straight. And honestly, I think they probably knew a lot of it wasn't true, but they didn't care. And so he thought that there were really, you know, probably dead people and dead bodies sort of littered across America. In fact, no one died. There were no serious injuries. I think one person reported a broken arm because they fell down a staircase. But even then, it was sort of like, well, did you fall down a staircase because you were afraid, or did you just fall down a staircase?
Right.
What we do know is that many, many people were frightened. And the big question, and this has been a big controversy over the years, you know, how many people were actually frightened? And there's been some research done on how many people actually heard the broadcast. And these numbers, a lot of people dispute these numbers today, but there's a researcher at Princeton right after it happened who he was the first one to really dive into this. And he came up with an estimate that between 4 and 6 million people heard the broadcast. Now, they heard portions of the broadcast. They didn't start out listening to it. They turned over to it when the Chase and Sanborn Hour turned out to be horrible. And so between 4 and 6 million people heard it. Of that 4 and 6 million, maybe 1.5 million thought it was an actual news broadcast and were frightened somewhere around there. But the important thing is what's been called the Paul Revere effect. It really doesn't matter how many people heard the broadcast. That's not the point. The point was that the people who heard the broadcast, many of them, then ran out and told other people what was happening, what they thought
right.
was happening.
Yeah.
And so it sort of spread like wildfire. I say it's sort of one of the first examples of viral marketing, but it's sort of and not in a good way. So, you know, they sort of harp on the fact that in terms of the actual population of the country, not a lot of people heard it, but it didn't really matter, because when you've got someone you trust, your mother, your sister, your brother, your friend, who's running to you in tears saying, you know, the Martians are coming, I just heard it on the radio, you know, and then that person tells someone else, and then that person tells someone else, and so on. So you can see how it spread. Now, was the entire country in a paralysis? No. But were many, many people in many, many cities deathly afraid for a couple of hours, and did it cause a lot of turmoil? Yes, absolutely.
Right. And plus, you kind of have, I guess you could call it like the no-hitter effect. You know, they always say, you know, if some guy throws a no-hitter and there's, you know, maybe 3,000 people there and the stadium holds like 30,000 people, and they're always like, oh, you know, 20 years from now, everybody's going to claim they were there. You know,
exactly,
and
exactly.
You're looking
at my point.
I was looking at the broadcast on YouTube today, and you know, within the first like 10 comments, someone's like, "My grandpa heard it, and he went out on his porch with his gun." And
right.
So it's like maybe he did, but part of me's like, maybe he just told you that because he was around when it happened and remembered the Führer, and it makes for a better story if you were freaked out by the whole thing and ran out with a gun rather than bemused by the whole thing.
Exactly. And, you know, I tend to think, because, you know, this researcher, his name is Hadley Cantrell, he made a really great point. He said that, you know, he had to survey people. He did a lot of interviews with people and phone surveys and things to find out, you know, to come up with this number of how many people listened to it. But he did it about a month after the broadcast, and by that time, a lot of people were embarrassed to admit that they had listened to it and that they were frightened. So a lot of people, when these pollsters called them and asked them questions, a lot of them, he thinks, just flat out lied and said, oh, no, I didn't listen to that, or, oh, I listened to it, but I knew it was fake. So, because, you know, there's a big ridicule effect. People didn't want to be seen as stupid. And so the actual number of people who listened to it and were frightened may have been you know, much larger. But you're right. I think there's definitely that sort of effect where a lot of people, I've heard the same thing from people, and it's just sort of like, wait a minute, did not everyone, you know, had this amazing experience, you know, where there was, you know, people running around with shotguns and things like that. But
right.
There was definitely some, there was definitely a lot of frightened people. And I go into it, in detail in the book. There was one tiny town named Concrete, Washington, which is like the greatest name for a small town I've ever heard. Concrete, Washington, where they just had the worst luck of all, because just as the story was getting going around like 8:15 or 8:20, and just as the Martians were invading and these people in this small town were listening to the broadcast and they thought it was real, a transformer blew in the town and all the electricity on their lights went out. And so they were cut off, and you know, so they suddenly had no power, no electricity, and they thought they were being invaded by Martians.
Oh God!
So it was just this sort of horrible, horrible thing. I'll tell you one more. My favorite comment. I found this. It was a telegram that I found in the National Archives, and a man in New York City. He actually sent this telegram to the FCC commissioner. The day after the broadcast, or I'm sorry, the chairman of the FCC, he sent it to him, and he sent this message, and he sent a $1 payment along with it, and the message said, please accept this dollar for making possible and endorsing the Mars invasion program, which scared my mother-in-law out of a year of her life. I wish I could send you more. I just thought that was like the greatest response.
And the other sort of, in addition to kind of like that no-hitter effect I was talking about, is also you presume that it became such a talked-about thing that nowadays you talk to your grandpa, your grandma, or whatever, they're not going to admit that they were actually listening to the Chase and Sanborn show and missed the whole thing, you know?
Exactly.
Everyone's going to be like, oh, of course I heard it. It was it was unbelievable, you know? And
right.
So as time goes on, it gets even more skewed, where it's people think that, like, everybody in the country was listening to this thing, but that's not the case at all. But a good percentage were, and a percentage of those people were pretty freaked out.
And what's interesting, you know, it doesn't take a lot to start a panic. That's the other thing, too.
Hmm.
And the question is, well, yeah, so, you know, the country didn't come to a standstill, but it was a big deal in, you know, every major city, you know. And really, when you think about it, you know, if you get people in New York City running out into the streets and people in Los Angeles and Oakland and, you know, Cincinnati and Cleveland, I mean, that's a big deal.
Oh, absolutely. And as you point out in the book, the technology was so rudimentary with the communication system that, you know, if there was going to be a real invasion, that would have been the ideal time to do it, because nobody could get through to the authorities at all in all these cities and everything, because all the phone lines were completely jammed.
Right.
So it's just... It's hard to imagine, I guess, that period of time and that night itself. And in the aftermath, I thought it was interesting. There's sort of like this progression of emotions that you detail in the book. You know, it goes from obviously the initial fear, then it turns to this embarrassment of being frightened and fooled, which then leads to this anger at Wells and the radio network and in the radio industry, fueled on by, of course, the newspapers. And then, thankfully, I guess, and you can kind of, like, flesh out sort of this progression, but then, you know, the anger subsists, and then it sort of turns into this sort of, like, almost appreciation for what went down.
Yeah, I think what happened was that there was really, for a few days there, you know, Wells and Houseman, and I mean, they were legitimate, they had a legitimate concern that they were going to be arrested. That there was going to be some sort of, definitely there was going to be some lawsuits. You know, something was going to happen because, you're right, you tracked it just perfectly. It started out, people were afraid and they were embarrassed and then they were angry. And people don't like being fooled or thinking they were being fooled.
Mm.
And so, and at the same time, and you had the newspapers sort of stoking the fire, and, because it was just great, it was a great way to sell newspapers. But what happened was around, I'd say about a week later, around November 4th, there was a very influential newspaper columnist. Her name was Dorothy Thompson, and she's almost completely forgotten today. She was very famous back then because she did a lot of reporting on what was going on in Europe. She's actually one of the few American journalists to actually have interviewed Adolf Hitler back in the early 1930s. And she was just very well known and very widely read. And she wrote a column about the broadcast. And Orson Welles and John Houseman and a lot of the people involved in this said, you know, when that Dorothy Thompson column came out, it really kind of saved us, because there were, for a while there, this really could have gone either way. This could have turned ugly, but she had such influence on the sort of intelligentsia and the sort of quote-unquote, you know, the smart guys and the people in Washington, especially the politicians who were, you know, calling for censorship measures and, you know, the networks should have to, you know, bring their programs, you know, before a federal board so they could be approved, you know, before they were broadcast and all this crazy stuff. And Dorothy Thompson came out with a very sort of out of left field analysis. And basically what she said was that Welles, Orson Welles, kind of had done the country a favor because he had shown what can happen to people when they're very stressed, when there's, you know, when there's social unrest around them, and he's shown how powerful mass media can be and how dangerous it can be in the wrong hands. Now, she wasn't saying that Welles was, had done anything wrong, but she's saying, look, you know, if this type of thing can set off this sort of reaction, imagine if someone was really trying to, you know, stir unrest or to start, you know, a war or something. It's like, look, we have to really look at how much trust and how much faith we put in the mass media and just really how important it is. I mean, radio is a very powerful tool. It can be used for good. It can be used for evil. And we've just seen how it can be used just by one guy in a studio, you know, in New York City. He can scare half the country. So, but she said it was the perfect demonstration, she said, is that the danger is not from Mars, but from the theatrical demagogue. And it was that column, really, it was just like, it just took all the air out of the balloon of the people who were trying to, you know, sort of have Welles hung in the public square, so to speak.
Yeah.
It really had an effect on people, and, it caused them to really think about it in a deeper way. It's like, okay, what can we learn from this? You know, how can we make sure that something like this doesn't happen again? And that was really, I think, a real turning point.
Exactly, because you really, it changed the paradigm of radio and the media, really, like, forever in a lot of ways. Because I think, as you point out, I don't know if it was you or Thompson that said, you know, it sort of stripped the naivete away from the American people as far as what they were getting via the media.
Right. It was sort of, it was a hard lesson for people, you know, but it's like, okay, look, you know, and I think it forced people to sort of look at themselves from a slightly different perspective and say, look, you have to be more careful. You have to be sort of aware of, you know, the situation and how you can be manipulated and how entire, you know, populaces can be manipulated. Because really she was saying, like, look, this is what's going on over in Europe, right?
Hmm.
With Hitler and how he's managing to just persuade these you know, millions of people to follow him and do what he says. And so she's really saying, look, this, we have to be careful here, but this, he actually, Welles had done everyone a favor by just exposing just, you know, how easy it is to start a mass delusion. That was the phrase she used. I was trying to find it there. How easy it is to start a mass delusion. And it really, as I say, it really changed people's thinking about it.
And the sad and scary part of it all is that 75 years later, we need another wake-up call like that.
Right. And I think this time around, it's the Internet, right? Wouldn't you agree? I think.
Yeah. I could see that.
The Internet is the most powerful, and, you know, Twitter and things like that. I think you're exactly right. I think you know, I think one of the reasons why it's been so popular over the years, the broadcast, is people kind of like to look back at the past and sort of make fun of people as being, you know, boy, those people were so unsophisticated back then. But we're in the exact, you know, we're in a very similar position now. You know, we have a shaky economy and, you know, unrest in the Middle East and elsewhere, and we're still very vulnerable to how media can be manipulated. You know, you have that great phrase, kind of scary phrase to my mind, you know, never let a crisis go to waste, you know, that think one of President Obama's chief of staff said, you know, right after the financial crisis, you know, that sort of shows what sort of the people in power think. You know, it shows how they think.
Yeah.
And how people can be, you know, crises, and how people's fears and worries can be manipulated through the use of technology, be it a radio or a computer or a smartphone.
Right. That's the, you know, like I said, it's sad and scary that for the people who aren't sort of hooked up to the underground media or the non-mainstream media, they need that wake-up call in a lot of ways, because they just believe whatever they see on Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. It's you know, it's scary in a lot of ways that it's going
right,
kind of back to square one.
I give the example in the book, just a real quick example,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Onion, you know, that satirical
yep.
website
yeah.
that does sort of the news parodies. Well, they sent out something on their Twitter account a couple years ago, basically saying that the Speaker of the House had, you know, whipped out a gun, and he was holding some children hostage in the House of Representatives, and I mentioned that in the book, and that actually scared a lot of people, and people actually thought that this Speaker of the House had gone insane, because they didn't realize, of course, the Onion was being satirical, but people, I mean, it was, they were looking on their smartphone, this popped up, and people started sending it to them and saying, oh my gosh, have you heard? Just exactly like what happened with the War of the Worlds broadcast. And of course, the Onion ended up having to apologize. But many people brought up and said, "Oh, wow, this is War of the Worlds all over again." So, yeah, we're not as smart as we think we are. I think if any time that you can be reminded that we as humans can be reminded that we're not as smart or as powerful as we think we are, I think that's a good thing. I think humility is a good thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Just, you know, for the people out there that are like, oh, I couldn't be fooled by something like that, wait till April 1st, because most news sites put out some bogus news story. And,
exactly.
you know, the better written it is and the closer it is to fact between fiction, you know, more people fall for it. I mean, more than once I've fallen for an April Fool's story that's like close enough to be true, where you're like, oh my God. And then later in the day, you're like, oh man.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So it's still absolutely possible nowadays. Now, obviously, as an avid listener of BOA Audio, I'm sure you're familiar with how War of the Worlds has been adopted or co-opted in a lot of circles, you know, the conspiracy circles and the UFO circles, that, you know, this was a setup, this was a plan, this was done, you know, to generate mass hysteria or to study mass hysteria or, you know, later on, we talked about this off the air, we can get into it a little bit now, but, you know, I think that it was later on used as a justification for the UFO cover-up, regardless of whether it was, you know, organized in the first place. But you argue in the book that, you know, this wasn't a plan by the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rothschilds to, you know, orchestrate mass hysteria in order to study it or something like that.
Right. And I say that, you know, reluctantly. I mean, I love a good conspiracy.
Exactly, yeah.
And I preface this by saying, boy, I wish this were true,
mm-hmm.
but unfortunately, you know, the facts just don't bear it out. I mean, the basic conspiracy theory surrounding the War of the Worlds broadcast was that it was an attempt by the Rockefeller Foundation, right? The Rockefellers always show up in these conspiracies, and they cooked this up with Orson Welles to deliberately frighten Americans because they wanted to see how people responded. They wanted to analyze and figure out how to best manipulate mass media to understand how these large populations reacted under stressful situations. Now, I, you know, have no problem believing that a lot of people will be interested in that kind of data and that a lot of people would want to do something like that. But it really wasn't, there's just nothing to back it up. The only thing that really, the reason why there's some sort of connection made is because the Rockefeller Foundation, they created something called the Princeton Radio Project in the year before, in 1937, and it was housed at Princeton, and it was basically a think tank, and it was just sort of created to study how radio was affecting American culture. And these things, you know, these types of societies and think tanks are funded all the time by rich people, but when the War of the Worlds happened the next year, the researcher who, you know, analyzed it and wrote a book about it was Hadley Cantrell from Princeton, and he worked for the Princeton Radio Project, and so people will say, aha, so he's the one. He was, you know, kind of in on it. But obviously, he didn't have anything to do with it. This was just, they were analyzing it because that's what, if you are studying radio's impact on American culture, you kind of can't ignore something like the War of the Worlds broadcast.
Right.
And also, Wells, you know, there's just zero evidence that Wells in any way, you know, colluded with anyone to do anything because he was barely there during the week that this was being done. As I say in the book, he was off, you know, rehearsing for a Broadway play, and he was, you know, having multiple affairs, you know, with people. And he was a busy guy.
He had better things to do.
Yeah, he had other things to do. And he kind of swooped in at the last moment like he always did, and sort of, you know, Saturday and Sunday afternoon sort of created this thing. So, but it really, you're right to say, I mean, this has really become, you know, I think a cornerstone of UFO culture and conspiracy culture. But unfortunately, in this case, there, in my opinion, there's really nothing to it. But boy, I wish there was.
That'd right.
Be a great story.
And like you point out about the quote there from the guy about never let a crisis go unutilized. I think I probably butchered that. But
go to waste.
Yeah. I think that mindset probably also applied to this, where, of course, there's a wealth of information there to be understood about mass hysteria and how it happens. So, of course, someone would be interested in it. They didn't need to manufacture it, but they certainly would take advantage of it happening.
Exactly. But you can't really fault them for that. Or,
oh, no, no.
Yeah.
No, it's human nature, you know? So, yeah, I would never be like, it would be criminal not to study that kind of thing.
Right, and before we were kind of talking about this, you know, before we started the interview too, I think, you know, one impact, you know, very real impact that the broadcast had was, I think it sort of, I don't know what the right phrase is, maybe it kind of softened people up a little bit and made them a little more receptive to the idea, again, you know, of things coming from out of the sky and that there's something going on up there that we don't realize. You should say, you know, Wells in later years has sort of bragged that he was the guy who really kind of started this whole UFO thing. Even though, and technically, these Martians, they flew down from Mars and they flew down in these pods and they landed in the ground. So, I mean, technically they were unidentified flying objects, right?
Hmm.
And so, he could sort of lay claim to that. But, you know, you think 9 years later when, Arnold came around and his description of these flying saucers, I think, my opinion is that I think the public was more receptive than they would have been had this War of the Worlds broadcast never happened.
Mm, yeah.
And I think it sort of brought the idea of aliens and UFOs and, you know, contact, it brought that into the mainstream. Because you think about it, before that, there was really no mainstream movie or book. Science fiction wasn't mainstream. It was the province of, you know, sort of pulp fiction, and it's what little kids read, and it was Edgar Rice Burroughs, and, you know, you sort of read it under covers at night with a flashlight.
Yeah.
But people weren't making blockbuster science fiction movies. Their science fiction movies were few and far between in the 1930s. And for that matter, it was, you know, it's pretty much straight ahead dramas and comedies and musicals. So I think that, you know, the War of the Worlds broadcast has sort of just brought the idea of UFOs and aliens and all of that into popular culture in a way that we just really hadn't seen before. And I think it started the ball rolling, for a lot of things that would come later.
And as I mentioned to you before we started the show, and I kind of alluded to it here, I definitely think that it was used, again, you know, utilizing the crisis in a way. I definitely think it was used as justification down the line for the UFO cover-up in a lot of ways. I believe it was even cited in one of these, you know, internal reports or something like that, that it was like, you know, based on the War of the Worlds thing, we can't be just announcing willy-nilly that there's aliens here because people are going to freak out, so.
Oh, right. Yeah, it was both... the perfect excuse to not disclose any information, because you're exactly right. Well, look what happened when you had just a few, basically, you know, a fraction of the American population thought we were being invaded. And you see how it tore up the entire country. Can you imagine if everyone all at once, simultaneously, you know, were told that, you know, aliens are in fact real. I think you're absolutely right. It became the ultimate excuse, and it also became the ultimate weapon with which to ridicule people who believed they had seen something in the sky, that they had witnessed something, because the quick, you know, almost automatic comeback was that, well, you're some of these crazy people who's going, you know, you're gullible, right? You're like those people who heard the broadcast and thought we were being invaded. And the people who, you know, originally saw, you know, witnessed these UFO sightings, you know, I've heard some recordings that MUFON and some of the UFO organizations made to their hotlines back in the 60s and 70s, and you hear a lot of these recordings of people calling in and reporting sightings, and it's kind of unnerving. It's kind of uncomfortable because these people are scared out of their mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're really like, their entire worldview has been shaken. And I think it's very easy in that type of situation for people to say, oh, well, you know, you're just overreacting, just like those people did who heard the War of the Worlds broadcast. So yeah, I think it's been used as both an excuse and sort of a weapon.
Right, right. 75 years later, the footprint still affects us today. It's amazing.
Exactly.
Now, just to we're heading toward the close here, just to sort of like, I guess, in a way, wrap up the story. Talk a little bit, sort of, about how Wells reacted to all this in later years. I thought that was interesting. You develop it quite a bit. You detail it quite a bit in the book, where it's sort of like you can never really get a read on what exactly his thoughts are on the whole thing. Sometimes he seems embarrassed by it. Sometimes he's sort of like the carnival barker, where it's like he's jumped on the story that it was all intentional and everything, because it makes him look. You know, he doesn't let facts get in the way of a good story. So,
I mean, that's the perfect way to put it. As I said before, I mean, he is a trickster, and he loved. I mean, again, it's so frustrating and infuriating. You're trying to write a book about this, and he'll say one thing one day and one thing the next. And what you have to remember about Wells is that he was a showman first and foremost. And what I think he would do was, if he was in a serious interview with, you know, say, a respected broadcaster, he would take the position that, well, of course I had no idea, and this was just sort of a terrible thing, you know, because I'm such a sophisticated person, you know, he would sort of play to his audience.
Hmm.
But if he was on, like, a talk show, an afternoon talk show or something, and there's a live studio audience there, he'd sort of give kind of a wink and a nod and say, oh, yeah, well, that was interesting what happened back in 1938. Gee, I wonder what happened there, you know. And he would sort of kind of take credit for it and kind of say that it was all a hoax. And then the next interview he did, he would say, oh, no, it wasn't a hoax at all. It was just a really unfortunate accident that happened. So you're right. I mean, but he would just play it for all it's worth. Whatever advantage he could get, you know, it really just depended on the situation. And if he thought he could make himself look good by saying he did it on purpose, he said he did it on purpose. And if he could make himself look good by saying it was just, oh, it's kind of embarrassing, I don't really even want to talk about it, let's talk about some of my more, you know, important and influential works, then he would take that tack. And so, you know, he was just a trickster to the end. I mean, he was just a guy who, you know, again, loved sleight of hand. He loved fooling people, and he really reveled in it. I mean, I think there were times that it irritated him because he wanted to be taken more seriously. But I think when he would go around and sort of try to promote his movies, I think that's when he was more willing to kind of go along with people who wanted to talk about it.
Right, right. I think that probably has a lot to do with sort of the mystique of this whole thing, you know, how the facts and the fiction got so blurred after 75 years, you know, when the creator of it all never really gives you a straight story about it.
Right. He did more to keep this legend alive than anyone, you know. Even though he claimed he didn't want to have anything to do with it, you're absolutely right. It's the fact that you could never pin him down, and that he was always sort of backtracking and saying, well, this happened and maybe that happened. And yeah, it was just great. I mean, Ringling Brothers, you know, Barnum and Bailey couldn't have done it any better than he did.
No, Now, where can folks pick up When Mars Attacked? Where, how can they get their hands on a copy of this book?
It's available on Amazon and Kindle. It's in the Kindle format. So if you have a Kindle reader or if you have an iPad, you can get the Kindle app for free or any sort of smart reader, or you can even read it on your computer. But they can get it there. And if they want to learn more about it, they can go to whenmarsattacked.com. And I have a press kit there. I have some a sort of overview of the entire event. If you want to learn a little bit more about it, I've got an excerpt from the book, you know, things like that.
Nice, nice. And as you said, you've been working on this thing for 3 years or so. What's next for David Accord? What do you have planned for your next project?
Well, I just finished this weekend, actually. I just finished. I wanted to do something a little less taxing. took so much time and effort, but kind of related. I'm a big fan. I don't know if you're familiar with the horror writer H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a big fan of his going back many, many years. And I just wrote as a brief, it's sort of like 10,000 words. It's sort of like a long essay or kind of a monograph. It's called The Other Mr. Lovecraft, and it's about one of Lovecraft's relatives. And Lovecraft, as you know, he has a very interesting history. His family tree is filled with, you know, madness and suicide and all this stuff. And a lot of people kind of speculate about how his genealogy sort of impacted these crazy, and incredibly scary stories he wrote. So I've written a book about, an incident, that occurred in the late 1890s with one of his relatives, and it's just fascinating. It's about suicide and spiritualism and a lot of interesting details about the spiritualism craze of the 1890s when it was, you know, that was the hot thing, people trying to contact spirits and deceased loved ones and holding seances and things. And so all of these things kind of converged together, and just the fact that it happened to someone, you know, in Lovecraft's sphere is just really interesting. And so it's called The Other Mr. Lovecraft. It's available on Amazon as well. I just finished that.
Oh, nice.
And I've got probably half a dozen other ideas. I have to commit to one now and just sort of, you know, stop sort of dancing around. But yeah. I don't know what's next.
And hopefully, as I said at the beginning of the show, you know, hopefully we're coming to people here on the 75th anniversary. What kind of big events or specials, or, you know, anything big, you know, to commemorate the big 75th anniversary in the works?
Yeah, well, probably by this time, if people are listening to this on the anniversary, which is fantastic, fantastic idea to do it then. You've probably heard a lot. I'm sure it's going to get a lot of media coverage.
Yeah.
I know that there's a lot of local theatrical companies that are going to be doing recreations of the play, you know, sort of on their own in front of live audiences. And also, there's a show on public television called The American Experience,
mm-hmm.
and they are going to also have a special documentary on the War of the Worlds broadcast, and I think it might also be, you know, on or around the anniversary date, but I think people are going to be seeing it everywhere because, you know, 75th anniversary is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it's kind of an oxymoronic question in a way because we're a part of that.
Right.
That
exactly.
Commemoration. So people might be listening to this and they may be seeing it everywhere already. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, if you're listening to this on October 30th, that chances are you turn on your radio tonight and some station somewhere will be playing that broadcast.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it, yeah.
So definitely, and if you can, folks, definitely check that out because it's amazing. And as I said, it holds up amazingly well. And with that said, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, David. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's right in the wheelhouse of where BOA Audio is going and has been going for the last few years, this sort of the marriage of the paranormal and the real and the fringe elements of the esoteric. And I absolutely loved the book, When Mars Attacked. Folks, go out and pick this up. You will learn so much about the War of the Worlds broadcast and the events that led up to it and how it all sort of came together. I mean, you really will get a fantastic understanding of what went down on October 30th, 1938, and you will definitely be so much more informed about this infamous broadcast. And that's thanks to David here. So thank you once again for coming on the show, pal.
Well, Tim, I can't thank you. Those are, I'm blown away. I don't know what to say. Those are some very kind words. And I just say, as someone who's been with you from the beginning, it's just been just fantastic, fantastic to be on the show with you. And thank you for taking the time to, first of all, read the book and then to ask such great questions. I really appreciate it.
Well, the pleasure was all mine, pal. And keep in touch, and hopefully we'll get you back on the show to discuss your other stuff.
That'd be great. Thank you very much.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 8. Big, big thanks to David Accord for coming on the show and providing a tremendous amount of enlightening information about the War of the Worlds. You can find out more about his book at www.whenmarsattacked. Pretty simple, all one word, When Mars Attacked. Once again, I cannot put this one over enough, folks. It is tremendous. And as hardcore BOA Audio listeners, I ask you to help out a fellow BOA Audio listener. And if you're interested, pick up When Mars Attacked. You will not be disappointed. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And stunningly, it is the first BOA Audio Listener Feedback of the season, even though we are up to episode 4. That is, of course, because we do not feature listener feedback on the live programs. So I thought it was high time to dig into the BOA Audio mailbag and read some emails from the BOA Audio listeners. The first one comes from Mike in France and Ken in Saudi Arabia, and here's what they have to say. Hey Tim, me and my brother drank a case of beer and ended up doing this jingle for you. Hope you like it. We enjoyed doing it. Love the show. Mike in France and Ken in Saudi Arabia. P.S. Visit my site at offtheloop.com. I'll post a What's Up review on your show. Bon courage. Not bon voyage, bon courage. I'm not sure if that's an actual French expression or just something that Mike made up, but I like it. So thank you for writing in, Mike and Ken. Chances are, if you tuned in to the very end of the last edition of BOA Audio featuring Peter Robbins, you heard the jingle that was created by Mike and Ken. I could not believe it when I first listened to it. I was completely blown away. It starts out slow and sort of intriguing, and then it gets wacky and hilarious and awesome and just strange. So tune in here to the very end of the show. You'll hear it. We're going to use that officially now as our closing song on the program because I was just totally thrilled by it. And it kind of captured the weird, wacky nature of BOA Audio. So kudos to Mike and Ken. See, some good things can come from drinking a case of beer. And the BOA Audio end show jingle is the perfect example of that. The next email comes from Joey, who posted on the Banal of America Facebook page. He says, proud to say I've listened to every episode, some of them twice, and a lot four or more times. One of the most comforting podcasts to me. There should be a club for listening to every BOA episode. Joey. Thank you for writing in, Joey. I'm amazed that some folks have listened to shows four or more times. Although I can imagine they would, because there are some episodes that are tremendous, and if I didn't create them and produce them, I'd probably go back and listen to them four or more times. Some shows I've listened to maybe three times between the editing and fixing up various aspects of it, but I gotta give kudos here also to Joey listening to every episode. I'm gonna assume that includes the much maligned and controversial baseball episodes. That's where you really separate the tremendously hardcore listeners from just the purely hardcore listeners, the people who tune in even to the infamous baseball episode. So maybe Joey can clear that up and get back to us on that. And since there is no club, I guess we'll call him the founding member of the Every BOA Audio Episode Club. Congratulations, Joey. The next message comes from Lawrence, who also posted on the BOA Facebook page. He says, according to my calendar, Ruxgiving is nearly upon us. This will give you a chance to discuss something that, remarkably, has never come up in all of your interviews. The Bionic Man versus Bigfoot. This came out in 1977 and has an incredible resonance with real events. First, Bigfoot is pals with the ETs. Also, the ETs are meddling with our nuclear program. The ETs have underground bases and also abduct people. You might be too young to remember this. I was about 6 when it came out and it blew me away, but I bet Rux has a lot to say about it. The full episodes used to be on YouTube, but alas, I don't know where they can be found for free anymore. I believe Hulu has it, but on the other side of their paywall. Please look into this, and be sure to ask old Bruce Rux what he thinks. Lawrence. Well, you're right, Lawrence, that I am too young for that one, because it came out in 1977. I was born in 79, so it was actually -2 when The Bionic Man versus Bigfoot first aired. I take it it was a TV show, because you say full episodes. And I'm completely out of the loop on this one, but I will definitely look into it. I've posted it here into my Rux Giving notes for this year's Rux Giving, and you give me a good chance here to plug Rux Giving, because we're only about 2 days away from November 1st, and that means we're really only about 3 weeks or so away from Rux Giving 2013. And once again, I'll turn over the question compiling duties to the BOA Audio listeners this year. Stay tuned to Banal of America and BOA on Facebook, where I'll have more information on that. I can almost assure you, as long as Bruce's schedule looks clear, that Rux Giving 2013 will be a live edition of the program. But, as always, stay tuned to BOA for more information. Speaking of which, I've got a couple of emails regarding the live program. I should probably tackle these as well. First one comes from John. He says, "Your last couple live shows were great, markedly improved. Except for every time I try the live button, it doesn't work. Still just MP3s. Aren't you guys standing by to go live when someone clicks the button? Maybe the button's broken." John. I presume he's making a joke here, because we're not trapped inside of a little room waiting to reprise the live show every time someone clicks the button. But I wanted to mention that, because I thought it was kind of amusing that he asked that. And I appreciate your kind words about the improvement to the live show. It's been a learning process. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a couple of weeks since I've done a live show, and I'm dying to get back on the airwaves, if you will, and do another live program. So hopefully the next edition of BOA Audio after this one you're listening to right now will be another live installment of the show. More information on that as we get closer to closing out this edition of the program. And I guess really the gist of what I should say here in response to John is there's only a small window of time when you can listen to us live. That's between usually 9 and 11 p.m. on Tuesday nights when we have a live show scheduled. So if you're trying to tune in Wednesday afternoon or Saturday morning, you're not going to be able to hear BOA live. Speaking of which, the other email comes from Vicky in Hawaii, who says, "I was so excited to hear you live on the air, but then when I got to the site, I am being forced to give my email in order to listen. After that, I am being conned into giving my credit card. God, Tim, I'm not going to do that to listen to you live. I'm deeply bummed, almost crying. Well, feeling hurt. Please make it stop. Aloha, Vicky in Hawaii." I have no idea what Vicky is doing here, folks. All you gotta do is click the link that takes you to the live program. Now, when I first previewed BOA Live on the season premiere here of BOA Audio Season 8, I told you to look for the next episode link on the homepage. But as you'll be hearing in a few moments, we've got a whole new layout at Banal of America. Here's how you're going to find the live show going forward if you want to listen live. Just go to banalofamerica.com and it will be the very first image on the homepage on our carousel. It will say live with the date and the time. All you've got to do is click that picture and it will take you immediately to the page where the program will start paying. You don't have to give your email. You don't have to give your credit card information. I'm not sure what link Vicky was clicking, but she was clicking the wrong link. Because it's pretty simple, and you don't even have to sign in or anything. The show should start playing once you get to the page. And if all else fails, you can't figure it out at all, just go to blogtalkradio.com and punch in Banal of America. That will bring up the page. That should easily guide you to the next live edition of the show. If you have any more troubles, folks, reach out to me, and hopefully I can help you get tuned in to BOA Live. And with that, we will pull the strings and close up the BOA audio listener feedback mailbag here this week. I'll definitely try and keep it going on the taped installments of BOA audio because I do enjoy reading these emails and responding to the BOA audio listeners. If you'd like to reach out to me for future installments of BOA audio listener feedback, there are a myriad of ways to do so. Simply go to banalofamerica.com, BINNAL of America.com, and click the contact button. Or you can write to BOAAudio@hotmail.com. Additionally, if you want something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, where we discuss the esoteric and pop culture, as well as whatever else is going on in the world. I would be remiss if I did not mention that I'm on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. That'll bring up my profiles. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, let me plug Banal of America on Facebook. We're up to 1,095 likes. We're kind of hovering there. We've plateaued a bit. We actually lost some likes. I don't know what I did wrong, but people unliked us. Other folks filled in the gap, so we kind of dipped and went right back up to the plateau of 1,095. Get us to 1,100, and you get the shout-out on the program. So if you have not done so yet, punch in Banal of America on Facebook or click the Facebook link at Banal of America and like us. Up next, please allow me to take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru Jeremy Boston. As I mentioned earlier, maybe I should have led the outro with this big news, but chances are you've already figured it out. We've got a whole new layout at Banal of America, kind of more of a blog layout, but we've kept the spine of BOA intact. So if you are very familiar with Banal of America, and you head on over to the website right now, it's going to look different from the way it used to, but you should still be able to find BOA audio very, very easily. And the cool thing about BOA 3.0 and the new blog infrastructure is that it's going to allow the BOA staff to post their own columns. They no longer have to rely on me to do all the formatting and uploading. They can just post their own stuff at the website whenever they want. And I'm in the process right now of getting them all registered and getting them all ready to go to post their own stuff. So soon, hopefully, they'll get their legs under them and start posting some cool stuff at BOA. And finally, I can also start bringing in other folks that I've wanted to have write for Banal of America, but I've not been able to really put it all together until now. There's going to be a lot of exciting stuff going on at BOA 3.0. In addition to the freedom that is afforded to the BOA staff, all of the posts at Banal of America now allow for comments on the website. So this is kind of fourth wall breaking in a way, but right now you can go to the website, you can click on the link here for David Accord's episode of BOA Audio, and then right in there underneath you can post your comments on the episode. Then I can add those into the pile of BOA Audio listener feedback stuff, or respond to your comments or questions right there at Banal of America. So essentially we're going to add another layer of interactivity to Banal of America. And one more thing, I want to take a moment here and thank Ray Weigel for all of his work putting together BOA 3.0. It's been a long process, and that's not Ray's fault, that's my fault, because this project would get tabled for weeks and months, and I'd have to come circle back around and be like, all right, I'm ready to take the next step on this project. It just took longer than I ever thought, and that was really on my shoulders. So a lesser web designer probably would have walked away months ago, but Ray was just overwhelmingly patient with my insane schedule and working with me, so I cannot put him over enough. Thank you so much, Ray, for all of your help getting BOA 3.0 up and running. And of course, big thanks to Jeremy Boston, who once again provided the awesome graphics at BOA. Thank you so much, guys, for your contributions to Banal of America. You're helping us move forward into a whole new era, and I am very excited about BOA 3.0. Up next comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA Audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Banal of America franchise. How do you do that? Well, you're in luck, because it is very, very simple. Just head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a donation via snail mail, it is very easy to do so as well, because we have a P.O. Box. Just send your donation to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address at Banal of America under the PayPal button. If you do send us a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America. And please include some form of correspondence so I can reach out to you and thank you for your donation, either an email address or a phone number, so I can give you a call or shoot you a line and say thanks for helping out BOA. As always, folks, it bears repeating, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, as I said earlier, I really want to do another live installment here of Season 8. I've got a pretty good list of folks that I need to reach out to and see if I can schedule for the show. In the event that their schedules do not work, we still have a tremendous after-death communication episode in the till. It was supposed to come out last week, but between a crazy work schedule and the amazing run of the Boston Red Sox here in the MLB playoffs, I have had almost zero time to devote to Banal of America. Thankfully, all of that is winding down, or will wind down, in the next couple of days, and we can really punch through these last 2 months of 2013 with some tremendous programming. So we've got the ADC episode in the pipeline. If I cannot schedule anybody for a live show next Tuesday, we will roll out the ADC episode. I should have an announcement either way on what the next edition of BOA Audio is for you by this coming Friday. So in the next 48 hours or so, check out Banal of America or BOA on Facebook to find out who will be on the next edition of BOA Audio Season 8. And on that note, we close the book on this installment of the program. Thanks once again to David Accord for coming on the show, and thanks to Vicky, John, Lawrence, Joey, and Mike, as well as Ken, for their contributions to BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And finally, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners. I told you this was going to be a season to remember, my friends, and so far it has been. Gone are the days of one or two or even three episodes in a month. Looking at the calendar right now, this is our fourth BOA Audio episode for October, and hopefully we can keep up this pace going forward throughout Season 8. And all of that is thanks to you folks out there and your enduring support of the program. I cannot thank you enough for being the fuel that drives the paranormal mothership. Thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.